Okay, this is Eric Elveson again, and I'm with today a friend of mine, Josh Reebok, who is an author, poet, and storyteller. His two books are Heroes and Monsters and My Generation, and he currently hosts a podcast called The Marrow, on which he interviews artists, musicians, and other creatives in the business world, but just in the creative arts. And Josh has spent a lot of time in and out of schools, around young people, around teachers, as a son of educators. But he's also in this process become somebody that I've learned a lot from in regards to storytelling and the creative process. So Josh, thanks for being with me and being part of this.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric. Great to be here.
Yeah. So question that you and I've talked about quite a bit, and you call yourself a storyteller, which I appreciate. But how is that different, you know, as you write books and as you go around, you know, speaking to larger groups, how is that different than somebody who's, you know, kind of the traditional preacher, the traditional speaker, or even more so of just a teacher of content and information?
Yeah. Well, can I say a couple things that I think storytelling and teaching have in common?
Absolutely.
I want you to think about for a moment, you know, think about what happens when you go into a movie theater, like what is going on inside of your mind, inside of your heart, and it may be going on subconsciously. The same thing happens if you are sitting, you know, in the fourth row before the curtain on Hamilton rises. It's the same thing happening when you open a book. It's the same thing happening when you go to a concert. It's the same, and it is the same thing happening actually if you were to sit in class. And what's going on in us as people when we enter that environment is we're looking for a reason to care. We are looking for a reason to care about what we are about to hear or see or experience. So what that means is either a storyteller or an educator, we share a common burden. And the common burden, the common challenge we have is, how do I get my audience to care about what I'm communicating? And so regardless of if it's, you know, William Shakespeare or Steven Spielberg or my sophomore year of high school English teacher, Catherine Ruck, they all share that same burden of how do you get someone to care. And so, and then a second thing that I believe storytellers or artists, however you want to categorize that, and then educators or preachers, however you want to categorize that, another thing they have in common is what I would call the need to be believable. Have you ever, Eric, seen the movie Walk the Line?
Yes, love it.
Okay, right. Great. I mean, If you like Johnny Cash, you're probably going to love it. I don't know if you don't like Johnny Cash, what you'll think, but it's a great movie, and it's about a big chunk of Johnny Cash's life. And there's a scene in the movie when Johnny Cash, who is played by Joaquin Phoenix, he goes to a recording studio for the first time with his two bandmates. And they go into the studio, and they sit down, and the producer says, all right, you know, play me something. And Johnny Cash starts playing this kind of old-timey gospel song. And within about three bars of the song, the producer waves his hand and he tells him to stop and he says, you guys got anything else? And at this point, Johnny Cash starts to become that sort of anarchist we know him to be, and his lips sneers and he kind of hunches over in his guitar and he says, is there something wrong with my gospel or is it just the way I sing it? And the producer says to him, he says, it's both. And he goes, well, what's wrong with it? That's the question Johnny Cash posed. He says, what's wrong with it? And the producer tells him something that I think is a flaw in a lot of environments where communication takes place, whether that's artistic or educational. And what the man tells Johnny Cash is, he says, the problem is I don't believe you. And in my experience, believability is one of the most critical elements for an audience member. And I use the term audience loosely, meaning a theater, an auditorium, or even a classroom. believability is one of the most critical elements for the people in the chairs, because unless we believe the person we're hearing from, it's really hard to care about what they're saying. If you think about, I think about this oftentimes in the world of music, and I could hear someone who has the most refined and perfect voice in the entire world. And you probably have had moments where you've heard really, really remarkable vocalists. But if you don't kind of believe what they're singing about, it doesn't resonate with you or stick with you or captivate you the way a singer who isn't nearly as proficient or vocally expertise might captivate you if you believe what they're saying. And so to me, some of the things that educators, storytellers, etc., all have in common, at least in terms of the challenge we're under, is first, I mean, how do we get people to care? And second, what does it look like to be believable when we're in front of these people?
The walk the line is a great example, because that scene especially, you know, it's there's a dullness to it. There's not a meaning to it.
Yep.
And he's just trying to follow and fit in. In the creative process, you know, as you've worked with people and as you've talked to, you know, these people on your blog and in the Marrow, and as you've spent time with other, you know, other artists and musicians, like how do you foster that believability, and how do you foster like the creative process to be able to communicate, you know, this common burden or the creation of that common burden?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, I get this privilege of spending time with so many remarkable people, and people who are working to kind of unleash whatever wonder is within them, and wonder exists in everybody. And you know, there's no same way. Like, obviously, these things we're talking about, these are inexact sciences, right? I mean, this is not as simple as making a recipe, but there do tend to be things that I find that the people that inspire me have in common. And one of the things that I think they have in common from a very personal standpoint is that they tend to have a high degree of introspection in their lives. In other words, they are aware enough of how to... of what is happening within themselves, so that then when they're presenting whatever it is they care about or whatever it is that they've made, that kind of sense of transparency in varying degrees tends to kind of seep through. So there does tend to be this sense of introspection, which is a little bit, feels like it gets a little bit lost in kind of the way the world is becoming, because we're so outward focused. We're always ingesting. You know, I mean, everything is content, content, content. So we're always taking in, but we're not necessarily pausing to familiarize ourselves with how we feel about what we're ingesting or even our opinions on things. And so a lot of these individuals that I get to spend time with that are kind of fostering that kind of creative fire in themselves, they tend to be, not always, but oftentimes they tend to be or have a high dimension of kind of contemplation, quietness in their life. They tend to retreat a lot from the world. And that doesn't mean that they're hermits, but it means that they retreat in order to process what it is that they're experiencing around them. Another thing about creativity is that, you know, these individuals that I get to spend time with, and I would say creativity as a whole, creativity requires time. There's a form of creativity that's kind of like the, you know, oh my goodness, like the deadline is coming. We only have X amount of days to do this. What are we going to do? And there's a certain creativity that can really blossom in that. But then there's an entirely different dimension of creativity that occurs when we let things marinate, so to speak. I was even reading this week, Christopher Nolan, who's a Hollywood director, and he directed what was the Batman trilogy of films kind of in the mid-2000s with Christian Bale, and it was Batman Begins and The Dark Knight Rises. And he was asked the question, what's the biggest difference you see in the films you made versus the way now, you know, almost 10 years later, that the superheroes are. And he gave a very simple answer. He said the biggest difference is time. And he said that he and his team had the time to be creative about kind of heavy questions and heavy matters, where a lot of individuals now in the directorial chair in Hollywood, they're kind of constricted to a 18-month timeline. And so it can hamper that sense of creativity. And then one more thing, I suppose, that comes to mind, and I don't know, you know, we didn't even get to, because I blew the question, but talk about all the differences between education and storytelling, and so there are similarities. But one thing that I find that might be a difference in that realm, and that I find a lot of these creatives in my life foster, is they see their art as a way of not of relaying, but relating. And storytelling and creative, I find that what creatives are often at the heart of it trying to do, we're trying to relate. And that's different than trying to relay, as in relate information. We're not trying to say, know these facts, we're trying to connect. And that is much easier done when we're aware of what's happening in ourselves. And that's much easier done when we're allowed to be a little bit maybe ambiguous in terms of what the agenda is, and education doesn't always provide that sense of bandwidth, because there are you know, requirements that need to be made, and there's specific things individuals need to know. But I do see that as a kind of a constant within creatives, is that they aim to relate, not just to relay.
So Josh, you know, as you were kind of growing up, and you know, in the different experiences that you had in school and playing sports, like, when did you figure out, not only do I have a talent for this, but I'm actually good at it, but then it's worth working at?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you feel this way, but I think depending on the day, I mean, this is Thursday now, and today I felt like I was good at it, but yesterday I felt like I was terrible at it. So I don't know if I'm ever going to reach that sort of oasis in my mind where I always feel like I'm good at what I do. But in terms of at least acknowledging an interest in it, and maybe even greater, and you just alluded to this, giving myself permission to be interested in it didn't happen for me until I was, you know, toward the backside of my 20s. I grew up in a home that was creative, but I wouldn't say that the cultural air around that home really kind of made a statement that the arts were a viable profession. I felt like I saw that they were viable hobbies. But in terms of committing hours and sweat and labor and money and time to an art, I never had a person in my life that had done that. And so I don't think I ever saw it as being viable. So even when I graduated from college, it took me another almost 6 years before I thought, I think I might be good at this. And more importantly, for me at that time, was going, and maybe it's worth pursuing. But I don't know. I think when I look at so many moments in my life, and not just in this conversation we're having, but so many, it's giving myself permission, or actually labeling my passions and talents as valid and meaningful. That's what propels me to follow them, not just the knowledge that I might have a knack for them. But for me, that didn't happen until I was, you know, as I mentioned, toward the backside of my 20s.
Okay. So, you know, as you, you know, you grew up in an education home, you know, we mm-hmm. were talking earlier before the recording started about you even possibly pursuing, you know, future education mm-hmm. in regards to some of this. And in schools, and like one of the popular things, you know, in the school worlds and education world is, you know, an emphasis on the arts. You know, they combine it with STEM, or, you know, call it STEAM or the creative arts, and they really push the arts. But you're telling me, like, these creative people that you've met, you know, is introspection, time, relating, just even your comment about just kind of your process of going through this. how in the world do you know, and you've been in enough schools, how in the world do we, you know, especially in a technologically driven world that we live in, and especially the conversation being highly pragmatic about what job you're going to get, how are you going to provide for yourself, how are you going to do this,
right?
You know, so you know, even from that educational standpoint or from the school standpoint, like how do you create this time and the introspection, or what suggestions would you have as you know, as everything seems like it's got to be blocked and pursued and structured and moved and
I wish I had the answer, obviously, and I absolutely do not. On top of some of those challenges we just mentioned, I think another great challenge is that to be creative, one of the things you have to be given, and that maybe that's something you give to yourself or something that someone gives you, but to be truly creative, you have to be given a grand permission to fail. You have to be given permission to try something that does not work. And I can speak for myself when I say I had such a fear of failure when it came to my education that a lot of times the creative risks weren't worth it. And so on some level, I think there has to be, if we truly want to foster creativity in an educational environment, we have to reward creativity, even if it fails, as opposed to accomplishment without risk. And, you know, that's not to say that, well, I'm taking a risk that 2 + 2 = 5, but we have to find environments and avenues within, like you said, a more pragmatic environment where risk is rewarded and not just correct answers. Because without that, I mean, that creativity really gets backed into a corner. And when I reflect back on my education, some of the individuals who kind of gave me permission to do that even just kind of breathed those early sparks of creativity into me that would later become a fire. Like I remember a second grade teacher of mine, name is Mrs. Landrum, and I remember her giving us an assignment about it was like a reading prompt, and the reading prompt was brief, and it was something to the effect of you're on a plane, you have your pet hamster with you, midway through the flight you look in the hamster cage and the hamster was gone. When you finally found him, the hamster was blank, and then you fill it in. And I remember sitting with her and going, well, what should I put? She goes, you can put anything you want. I was like, yeah, but, and even as a second grader, I was kind of trying to feel my way to the answer she wanted. And after multiple reinforcements from her saying, no, it can really be whatever you want, I went back and I wrote my story. And when in my story, when I finally found the hamster was flying the plane. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever, that I could make the hamster fly the plane, as outlandish as it seemed. You know, Eric, I haven't done it recently, but for a while, every year I would go to a fourth grade classroom, this amazing fourth grade classroom in out in East Texas. And I would go there for 2 days. This wonderful teacher invited me to come and to talk about storytelling and writing with her students. And similar to Mrs. Landrum, I was amazed at how, when we began, we'd say, all right, here's some couple things you need to tell a story. You need a character, you need a setting, and you need an event. Without those things, it's hard to tell a story. And initially, when you start with this room of fourth graders, and I'm there at the blackboard, and I say, all right, let's just give me ideas. What's our setting? And every time I did this, every class, every year, it was predictable. If you were in Vegas, you would win a lot of money if this was a prop bet. That at the beginning, all the kids were going to use very, very practical things as if they were trying to find the answer that I wanted. So when I would say, what's the setting? They would say, East Texas. They would say, my house. They would say, the school. And then when you start to tell them, no, it can be anything you want. Then they go, okay, Washington, D.C. And you go, no, it can be anything you want. And as you go and as you kind of nudge them, away from the quote-unquote right answer. By the end, they're going, okay, it's an ocean on Mars, but the ocean is made of Kool-Aid. That's the setting. And they start to kind of take down these cautious walls and surrender to their imaginations and their creativity. But what strikes me is that by the time we're in fourth grade, we're already searching for the right answer and assuming that creativity is not going to lead us there. And so I think creativity, it feels at times, even to me, it's a bit antithetical to some of the environments in which I've been educated, because it felt like creativity never led me to the right answer, even though it may have led me to some really, really remarkable things instead.
Okay, so this maybe gets me to possibly the last question. You know, as you talk about that, fourth graders, or even yourself as you're writing, whether it be poetry or whether your books or just telling stories or just working on this process, there's this tendency to want the story to mean something or to get at something. Or, you talk about what's the answer. And we love to analyze art, and we love to say what was trying to be communicated. But at what point in time do we appreciate the story, the art, the work for just what it is? And then how do we just enjoy, but then how do we also kind of look deeper and ask those questions without ruining the enjoyment of what we've been given from this artist?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. To me, you know, the best stories are the one that begin in the mind of the storyteller, but end in the mind or in the heart of the audience. In other words, the audience isn't told what to think, but they're given space to think for themselves. They're not told what to feel, but they're given space to feel. I don't know if, you know, you ever listen to like opera. I don't make it a large habit or anything. but there have been moments when I have either been watching TV or randomly listening to something, and I'll hear like Pavarotti singing in Italian, and I'm moved to tears. Mm-hmm. Even though I have no idea what he's saying. And there's something about, you know, taking the practicality out of it that removes the question that I find often inhibits personal growth. And a lot of times the question that drives us, and I think this is often true in education, and it's even often true, I would say, in religious environments, we're asking, what does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? And that question can become so dominant and cast such a long shadow over us in the process that we no longer just give ourselves space to think or just to feel. And so for me, when I am you know, reading something or I hear a song, I try, though I certainly ask the question, what does this mean? But I think a more valuable question at times can be, how do I feel about what I'm hearing? Or how does what I'm seeing make me feel? What does it make me think about? Because then that gives somebody the chance to grow personally and not just from a knowledge standpoint. And I mean, you know, I suppose to go back to, you know, something we mentioned before, then that's relating. Now I'm relating to the story, and I'm not just having something relayed to me. I mean, I like to think of art, you know, like, and stories as Rorschachs. You know, Rorschach is the German psychiatrist who did that's a more scientific term for what's known as an inkblot test. And though the science has been debunked as faulty in a lot of ways, there's some truth in it, in that if I draw an inkblot and I hold it up and I go, Eric, what do you see in this? Whatever you see in it says way more about you than it does me. And there's a principle of that in art, that if you and I look at a painting, what you see in it says a lot more about you than it does the person who painted it. And so I think there's something wonderful in that, that when we don't embrace that, I think really gets lost. And so to welcome that, I think it's powerful. And I don't know, I mean, the things that I've been moved most by are probably the things that have given me the space to relate and connect with them on my own terms. I mean, I'm sure, Eric, you've had it before where you've had, you know, some moment you've seen something or whatever, watched something, and then you're conversing with your spouse or friend later, and you go, what? Oh, I loved it when the person said this. And you're like, I don't think they said that at all. But they're kind of connecting with it in such a way that they're kind of having a unique experience that not everybody has. And I think that's one of the powers of art that other things don't necessarily provide.
Well, it reminds me, you know, some of this reminds me of, you know, we used Walk the Line earlier, you know, as a movie, and you talk about Dark Knight, but it's also Shawshank Redemption when Andy Dufresne ends up in the warden's office and locks the door and puts the record on the player and puts it over the loudspeakers and then turns up the volume on what was an incredibly beautiful song, but it was in a foreign language that nobody understood. But then the way that they created that part of the story. And then later when they ask Andy what she was singing about, you know, there is some sort of comment, but it doesn't really matter. Because he was able to bring that beauty and that opportunity to this place and into his life, but then share it with, you know, his fellow prisoners in that.
Yeah. And what you just said, Eric, is become such a communal part of art that adds a whole nother layer. Is you and I could read the same book, hear the same song, or hear a Hans Christian Andersen fable. We might each take something different from it, might move us, might make me angry, and might move you to tears, whatever. But then an additional part of the power of that is what you just said, that then you and I get the power to connect, not just over the story, but I get to share with you, man, here's why it made me angry, because when I was 25, and now you and I get a chance to relate. And so art and stories and movies and books and painting, sculpture, dance, on and on and on, the power isn't just that we as individuals get to relate to the art and the artist gets to relate to us. The power is then, apart from the artist and the art, we get to relate and connect. And so it becomes this real sort of democratic communal experience that few other things in life can really offer.
Okay, so here's my truly last question then, because because it is about relating, and you've talked about, you know, the fear of failure, and you've talked about, you know, this communal nature of art. I grew up with a father who is an artist. I have a wife who's an artist. You know, I'm not very artistic, but I enjoy, you know, certain aspects of art that I've found that I just enjoy. In that communal nature, in that fear of failure, it's incredibly personal. So how do you, you know, and I'm sure for you, it's with when you're doing poetry or when you're writing a book, other people are going to read it and judge it. And how do you get over some of that personal fear of judgment to actually produce the art so that it can be shared by a wider audience?
Eric, your only chance is to drink a lot. It's hard, man. It's hard. I mentioned before we started recording, I just sent my newest book off to my agent and last week, and it's terrifying. And I'm more than 10 years into full-time writing and storytelling, and I'm no less scared of it now than I was then. And, you know, I don't know if I ever will be, but to me, the question I have to come back to is, one, do I want to be the kind of person who allows my fears to bully me out of my own creativity? And I know the answer to that. I have to kind of ask questions to my idealized self. You know, would the best version of me not make something for fear of reprisal or judgment? And I know the answer is no. But then the other thing I have to remember is, and I'm kind of a quote fiend, a bit of a quote glutton, and so forgive me, but there's something T.S. Eliot talks about, and he talks about it, I think, specifically with poetry, but I think it applies to a lot, and he says poetry or art is the process of self-extinction. And having never met him, I don't know what he meant. But part of what I take from that is that to truly make something, to truly be creative, I can't be concerned with how people are going to perceive me, the artist. I have to allow any sort of self-consciousness to become extinct in the process, or otherwise I'm not making it about the art, I'm making it about me, the artist. And that's when I start to go, oh, I shouldn't write that, I shouldn't say that, because people might think something of me. And so whenever I become at the forefront of a sentence that I'm deleting, that's a problem. And so I have to remind myself, the gift I'm giving people is not me, it's the art that I make. And to do contrary to that, to me, is when I'm most selfish in what I make. It's when I'm most false in what I make. I mean, it's essentially when I'm trying to maintain to my readers or an audience a persona, and at that point, I'm not really relating to them. I'm relating my persona to them. And so though those fears always exist, a couple of those things, you know, help guide me. And I actually even, I ask my editors along the way when I'm writing something, especially, I ask them, will you please tell me if you think I'm hiding in a certain part, or will you call me on it if when you're reading something and you think I'm kind of on my heels, so to speak, while I'm writing and leading away from honesty and away from creativity rather than leaning toward it.
Josh, I really appreciate it. I'm thankful for, you know, the years I've gotten to hear you, you know, be a storyteller and speak to crowds and audiences, and the opportunities to read your books and to hear your poetry, and just, you know, the opportunities we've had to sit over dinner or over conversations and have many of these questions. I really appreciate it. And so thanks for joining me for this blog, and I'm excited to be able to share it with other people.
Oh, man. Well, thanks so much for having me, man. And, yeah, you've been an awesome friend to me for a long time. Thanks so much for having me.